everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we're going to take a special look at the corruption and illegal operations of the CIA and its influence upon our elected government. My guest is Douglas Valentine. Douglas will be speaking with us from Massachusetts. Douglas is an independent researcher, investigator, author. There are very few researchers in America who have done the in-depth investigation into some of the darker corners of modern American history involving our federal intelligence agencies, most notably the CIA. In his book on the secret CIA covert operation known as the Phoenix Project during the Vietnam War, Douglas exposed all of it. He was the first, and it's regarded as the definitive study on this subject. His collection of Vietnam documents at the National Security Archives have been used by researchers for a decade. His larger book on the U.S. secret war on drugs has received academic awards of excellence. His most recent book, The CIA as Organized Crime, How Illegal Operations Corrupt America and the World, is a voluminous account of the history of the CIA corruption from its founding to the present, and why we should not consider the agency's self-interest as contrary to the national and public good. His website is douglasvalentine.com. Nice to have you with us today, Douglas. I feel it behooves us to start at the beginning. Before the CIA, there was the OSS, which people remember as a major American agency during World War II. At that time, the CIA was assigned a specific mission in the United States government and foreign policy. And then over the years, it morphed into something far beyond its original mandate as a data collection agency and spy operation focused solely on America's declared enemies. So in the first part of the question, I'd like you to explain the CIA's original purpose and mission. And what were some of the more important benchmarks or events and changes that transformed the CIA into almost an independent government to itself, that only answers to itself, with its own political, economic, and social agenda that has made it corrupt, deadly, and engaged in countless illegal activities. Then to follow that, please address the CIA's role in our domestic economy. You've charged the CIA with working with bankers and Wall Street, and how its pro-capitalist, pro-war, anti-progressive, and anti-social agendas favor a war economy in order to manipulate the economy to the benefit of the elite. And in return, many of the mega corporations rely upon the CIA to forward their ambitions. It has been suspected that even Obama, after graduating from Columbia University, worked as an editor for one of the CIA economic operations. It was called the Business Corporation, a non-public entity. So you could recreate for us the CIA's worldview, its broader domestic and geopolitical vision, and the role it perceives itself as playing to reach those visions and goals. The forum is yours.
Thank you very much for having me on your show, Gary. That's a gigantic question that you asked me, but I'll do my best to sum up what is, you know, not just a matter of specifics, but is kind of almost a philosophical question that you posed to me. As you know, until the 20th century, the United States was primarily concerned with its westward expansion and with defining its boundaries with Canada and Mexico. And even in World War I, there was a large segment of the government that was isolationist, didn't want to join the United States after World War I, did not join the League of Nations. And at that time, a kind of parallel government began to develop. It was the government of the Foreign Relations Council, and the corporations got together and they wanted to do business overseas, and they formed a sort of parallel government that conducted diplomacy outside of U.S. Congress. and outside of the executive branch of the government. And when World War II came along, the whole world found itself at war, and the United States was right in the middle of it, President Roosevelt created the OSS, the Office of Strategic Studies, in order to conduct operations that were illegal for the U.S. military to conduct. It wanted to do things in countries that were neutral, where the United States Army wasn't operating. It wanted to do things behind enemy lines. And the only people in the government, in the country, who were capable of forming the OSS, or staffing out this intelligence service for President Roosevelt, were these corporate people who had had businesses overseas, and they could speak Chinese. They had been operating in Chinese for decades, or they were had a typewriter company in Italy, like James Angleton's father did. James Angleton would become the counterintelligence chief of the CIA. He had spent a lot of time growing up in Italy. So it was this faction, the internationalist faction of the United States, came to prominence in World War II through the OSS. And at the end of the war, when the United States found itself with military bases actually occupying much of Germany, Austria, it was putting together all of Europe through the Marshall Plan. It had bases in the Philippines, in Japan. It had basically taken over the Japanese government. It was this cadre of people from the OSS who said to the president and later Truman, who became the person who authorized the creation of the CIA, that we need a permanent OSS. We need to maintain this espionage intelligence apparatus that was set up in World War II through the OSS in order to maintain all the investments now that we have in the world through the military occupation and reestablishing democracies throughout Europe and even into Latin America. And of course, the great bugaboo was rolling back communism. In Eastern Europe, it was the Soviet Union. And after 1949, it was trying to contain China. And a lot of these operations were not strictly military. They were paramilitary, and they were espionage operations that were designed to provoke trouble in the border regions, in the satellite countries of the Soviet Union in Europe. And the military couldn't legally conduct those kind of operations. And the State Department, which had done that sort of thing, like with baby steps prior to World War II, just wasn't up to it. So they needed the CIA to do that. And laws were passed. The National Security Act was passed, which granted the CIA the power to conduct criminal activities all around the world. And rather than calling them criminal activities or saying that what you're going to be doing is illegal, they called them extra-legal operations. The Congress passed a law, the National Security Act, that said in order to preserve the national security interests of the United States, we actually need an organized crime branch of the government that can conduct all these illegal operations. And these illegal operations are across the board and encompass everything that you can think of that would be illegal, from paramilitary operations that involved, forming a militia somewhere so that it could attack an enemy government, to traditional espionage operations, which at their heart are illegal. We have an FBI here in the United States that provides a counterintelligence service to protect our country from foreign intelligence operations, from people coming into the United States, Soviet agents or Chinese agents, and bribing our politicians or bribing our businessmen coercing them in some way to make them give up secrets or talk about what our plans and strategies are as a country. And that's a very serious crime. Chelsea Manning went to prison, just got released, for revealing secrets that were, you know, said to be like espionage. Well, all these kind of illegal operations that we've tried to protect ourselves against is exactly what the CIA does overseas. I'm sure your audience is aware of it, but the CIA is interested not just in conducting espionage operations in enemy countries, as you said, but it wants to know, for what are basically economic reasons, on behalf of this the economic class, the industry in the United States that is now based overseas, they want so that they have an advantage in operating in foreign countries. They want to know what the plans and with Merkel's plans and strategies are in Germany. They want to know whether France is going to be selling warplanes to Saudi Arabia so that if they can underbid them. They want to, you know, apart from wanting to know what ISIS is up to, they want to know, well, you know, what's the next islands that China is going to be paving over in the South China Sea? And in order to do that, in order to know what the plans and strategies are of every foreign country in the world, because we're now one global society, the CIA has a station in every country in the world. They usually operate out of an embassy. But they also have safe houses, and they conduct all sorts of anything you can imagine they do. And the purpose is to get business people in foreign countries, politicians in foreign countries, police and security officials in foreign countries to go to work secretly for the United States. It's illegal. They can't figure out everything simply through NSA wiretaps of listening in on people's phones. They actually need to put penetration agents into foreign countries. People who, they need to hire somebody who's, for example, a lieutenant in the Bolivian army and keep him on the payroll as he goes up and gets promoted throughout his career and becomes a major. And then one day suddenly he's a general. And all of a sudden, the CIA has a general on the general staff of the Bolivian army, and they can find out what the plans and strategies are of the Bolivian army. Well, they're trying to do that in every country around the world. They're trying to do it in every country's military. They're trying to get agents, recruit agents in place so that they tell them what's going on. They're trying to do it in the parliament in the Philippines so that they know they can influence legislation that's passed in the Philippines so that if Westinghouse wants to build a nuclear power plant in the Philippines, they can get enough votes together in the Philippine Congress to give a contract to Westinghouse. All these things all around the world. And all of these things that they're doing, the recruiting of security officers, let's say a security officer in Poland, who, without the Polish government knowing it, will allow the CIA to kidnap a foreign terrorist on its property, or to build a safe house where they can interrogate secretly people that they can't interrogate here in the United States. And it's not that the CIA there's been any one event that has occurred in the history of the CIA that has moved it forward in sort of some sort of monumental way. Obviously it was a much smaller organization when it started 70 years ago, but as it's increased, as technology has increased and improved, when the CIA was created, it was still unusual for somebody to take a plane overseas. You know, now people are jetting around the world. The communications have improved. The ways, the technology for conducting espionage, for conducting wars, all these things have improved. The science, the CIA has an entire science and technology division. The science has advanced. They're at the forefront. They hire the biggest brains in the country from who are involved in laser technology, in Star Wars technology, and satellite technology. They hire the best anthropologists, the best psychiatrists, the best sociologists, the best anthropologists. 75 years ago when the CIA began, people didn't know that there were what the tribes in the mountains of Laos and Vietnam were thinking. Well, now they know. I mean, things have advanced to the point where the CIA now has operations everywhere and the capability to place agents and control governments and social movements and political movements in every country in the world. And it's done with the an eye to management and organization. They hire graduates from Harvard and Yale and Columbia University who graduated magna cum laude in how to organize and create systems for controlling people. And these things are now so much more amazingly sophisticated than they were 75 years ago that unless you have a PhD in each one of these subjects, you can't really realize how awesome the power of the CIA is. And of course, the overriding thing is that all this is secret. You're not allowed to know the extent of its powers. There was a very famous Frenchman named Guy Debord who said that secrecy dominates this world, especially as the secret of dominance. And the thing that protects the CIA is that it's illegal to talk about any of the things it does. So not only does it have this elaborate, systemized, all omnipotent, ubiquitous system set up, it operates in secrecy, and it's illegal to break that, to violate that secrecy. Plus, the other overriding factor is that its greatest strength is controlling the kind of information that we receive through censorship and through secrecy, so that what we know about it, about the CIA, is what they want us to know. They create a story about themselves of the hero who's out there defending the United States. But they don't tell you what they're really defending and what they're really advancing hasn't changed in the 75 years since the CIA was created. It's still advancing the interests of and defending this corporate class which originally formed it. And this corporate class which originally formed it also included academics and people from the media. And we know from a time, 40 years ago when there was actually a lot of exposés at the end of the Vietnam War, the Church Committee, investigations of the CIA, things that have not been duplicated since then, that one of the things that the CIA focused on really intently through its what was called Operation Mockingbird was controlling the media in the United States, controlling Hollywood, controlling the publishing industries, controlling the media, and co-opting people in the media and bringing them, making them compatible and believing that the CIA's mission was important. And over the 75 years since its creation, it's evolved to the point where there is actually no difference anymore between the CIA and the government and the media. They're all the same thing. And this is largely a result of developments since 9/11 and, of course, the advent of the internet, which has now led to, a lot of confusion. So anyway, you asked a big question, and I did the best I could to try to sum it all up. So if you have another question, please fire away.
Well, that was a 20-minute mm-hmm. answer and a very definitive answer, mm-hmm. and I appreciate it, and I'm sure the audience does as well. Now, for your next question, what is the relationship between the CIA mm-hmm. and now the Department mm-hmm. of Homeland Securities that was created during the Bush administration? And introduce us to a Major General Bruce Lawler. And what is the nature of that relationship? And does that enable the CIA to be more involved in domestic surveillance, which was not its mandate, and spying that has usually been under the auspices of the FBI?
Good question. And keeping in mind everything that I've said to you, let me just backtrack a little bit and say that when I started researching the CIA, it was 30 years ago, 1984, and I went to, not knowing any better, the man who was most associated with the Phoenix program, and that was a guy named Bill Colby, William Colby, who had been head of the CIA. He had actually run the Phoenix program in Vietnam, and the war was 10 years over, and I went to him. He was no longer in the CIA, and I told him I wanted to write a book about the Phoenix program, and he was very, for reasons that are too complex to explain, he decided to help me, and he started introducing me to CIA officers, and over the next 4 years, from 1986 to 1990, and even afterwards, I interviewed about 100 CIA officers, people that, including many, many top officials that Colby introduced me to. So I carried his impromptu and people spoke to me very honestly and forthrightly in a way about the CIA that doesn't usually happen. In fact, I don't know that it's really happened to anybody else. Certainly nobody else wrote about it the way I did. And one of the people I met was a CIA officer named Bruce Lawler. I'll tell you a little bit about his background because he represents the ideological mindset of a CIA officer. He was going to college in Washington, D.C. during the Vietnam War. And upon graduating around 1969, he was recruited into the CIA, and he went to their training school in Williamsburg, Virginia. And around 1971, he was sent overseas to Vietnam. And he was trained in both paramilitary activities, which for a CIA officer means creating militias, paramilitary militias, and teaching them how to shoot guns and blow things up. And he was also trained in agent operations, which means working in liaison with the policemen in South Vietnam, their special policemen like their FBI, conducting agent operations against the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese. So he was doing a lot of very important things, and he was up in the northern part of the South Vietnam, up near the DMZ in a place called Da Nang. And he had a couple of experiences there that really affected him very deeply. One of his jobs was being an advisor to an interrogation center. Starting in 1965, secretly, the CIA built an interrogation center in each of South Vietnam's 44 provinces. These became one of the foundation stones of the Phoenix program. And in 1971, Lawler was an advisor, a CIA. The interrogation center was staffed by members of the police special branch in South Vietnam. The special branch was entirely funded by the CIA, and it built all these interrogation centers and gave them over to these people. It trained all their interrogators. It read all the reports coming out of the interrogation centers. And Lawler found himself advising the people in one of these places. And one day he walked in and he saw that a Vietnamese woman, a suspected Viet Cong agent, had been raped and murdered. And her body was laid out on a table. And there she was. And he saw what had happened. And this profoundly affected him. And he went to his bosses and he said, "This horrible crime has been committed. We should do something about him." And they told him, "Get used to it, kid. This is the way things happen here in Vietnam." And then he had another second experience. After he had been there for over a year, was after the ceasefire. And supposedly the CIA wasn't supposed to be conducting any operations anymore, but the boss in Da Nang was a senior CIA officer who had been there for, been in the CIA since its inception. And his tour as the boss of Da Nang was going to be his last tour in Vietnam. I mean, as a CIA officer. And he was, of course, I interviewed Lawler, and he was telling, he told me all this stuff. I'm not making it up. And he, it's written about in my book. And Lawler discovered that this senior CIA officer was having an affair with a Viet Cong woman, an agent. And it astounded him. And he went and he told the deputy, you know, the boss is actually involved with a Viet Cong agent. And they said, you know, get used to it, kid. This is the way we work. So Lawler made the mistake of going to security officers in Saigon, back where the CIA station was, and he complained about the war crime he saw, and he complained about his boss having an affair with an enemy agent. And within a week, he had been sent back to the United States, and shortly thereafter, he was cashiered out of the CIA. And he went back to Vermont, where he grew up, and he became a lawyer. But, and this is the important thing to understand, there was a part of him that still wanted to be a member of the CIA. It's a very powerful, empowering thing personally to be part of an organization like the CIA. You have the freedom to commit all sorts of crimes. You can do whatever you want and you can get away with it. And the things that you're doing that are actually affecting world events. So it's a very powerful feeling. There are not a lot of people that do these sorts of things, and they're very carefully screened and indoctrinated. And Bruce Lawler wanted to get back into the club. And he was running, he ran for attorney general in Vermont. And while he was running, the interwar people in Vermont found out that he had been in the Phoenix program and in the CIA. And they publicized this, and his campaign fell apart, and he did not get the nomination to run for attorney general. And William Colby, who I mentioned earlier, also grew up in Vermont, knew about it, had actually gone and campaigned for Lawler. And through Colby, Lawler, his career in the national security establishment was revived after this event, after him losing this election. And he had always been a reserve military officer. And all of a sudden, he went back and he became an active duty military officer, and he progressed from one rank to another. And by 1999, he was actually a major general in charge of one of joint special operations that were involved in civil affairs all around the world. And when, after 9/11, when the Department of Homeland Security was created, because of his experience in what are called military civil operations, Bruce Lawler was appointed the first chief of staff of the Department of Homeland Security. Now, how does a person move through the national security establishment in that particular way? Well, I'm telling you that Bruce Lawler's not the only one. There are dozens, hundreds of people in our government, not just in the military, not just in the Department of Homeland Security, but in Congress and in business, who over 75 years that the CIA has existed have participated in CIA operations, have worked for the CIA. And after their CIA careers, they go into public service, or they run for election and they get elected. And yet, because they've been part of this organized crime branch of the United States, and they've been committing crimes all around the world, you always have to wonder, well, who are they really serving? Are they serving the people they're supposed to represent? Or are they still part of this old boy network? And is that where their loyalty really resides? And especially with the Department of Homeland Security, the CIA, since the world has become sort of a global village, its influence in the Department of Homeland Security, just like its influence in the DEA, has become almost pervasive through individuals like Bruce Lawler, who had past associations with the CIA. And it's just massive. It's like an entire witness protection service for ex-spooks.
I'd like to progress to another area. There are many examples of CIA operations that we could explore. Its role in Iran-Contra, in drug smuggling, and the cocaine trade. Its operations in Afghanistan, in Iraq, Ukraine, Mexico, and its role in terrorism in Latin America and others. But I'd like you to speak a little about you've talked about the Phoenix program, but this is one of the most horrendous examples of explicit war crimes the CIA has condoned and executed. So even though you've spoken about this briefly, tell us a bit more about what the Phoenix program was and what was its motive in crimes. And then what do we learn from this example that helps us better understand CIA operations in other countries and operations such as the Middle East and the funders of Islamic Salafi and jihadi organizations?
Another big question. I'll do my best. The Phoenix program is the model for both the Department of Homeland Security and the War on Terror. You may be aware that just the other day, Breitbart published an article. This guy, Prince, who ran Blackwater Security Service, is an advisor to Donald Trump, suggested to Trump that to create a worldwide Phoenix program. It's in the news. You can go read about it. It made the news yesterday and today. The Phoenix program is very much alive, and it's very much in the minds of the people who are the lineal descendants of the actual Phoenix program in Vietnam, where the CIA created it back in 1967. It's very, very complex. Almost take an hour to explain it, but it was created by a guy, a CIA officer named Nelson Brickell, who was a Yale graduate cum law, and his expertise was in organizational behavior and management. And he was assigned to Vietnam in 1966 at the same time, 1965, at the same time that the U.S. Army started pouring hundreds of thousand troops into Vietnam. At the same time, the National Security Council and Lyndon Johnson understood that in order to win the Vietnam War, it wasn't enough to defeat the North Vietnamese Army. They had to destroy what they called the Viet Cong infrastructure, the National Liberation Front of Vietnam. This was the civilian apparatus. It was a secret parallel government which had the support of most of the people, the citizens of South Vietnam. They did not support the American-backed government in South Vietnam. The actual rural people supported the Viet Cong, and they had a secret organization which had a hierarchy that went all the way back to the to Hanoi, but which also operated at the in every province and every district and every village in Vietnam. This is a civilian apparatus. The United States Army was not legally allowed to target civilians in time of war. So the job of targeting this civilian apparatus fell to the CIA. I was explaining that to you in the beginning, where the CIA is created to do what are called, what the United States called, extra legal operations, things that go beyond the Geneva Conventions. And this guy, Nelson Brigham, combined every military and civilian police and intelligence organization into what was called a General Staff for Pacification. And that became the Phoenix Program. And it targeted, it identified in every province and district and village in South Vietnam who the members were of this secret apparatus. There were estimated to be around 250,000 people that were involved in this secret apparatus, shadow government. They identified every one of them, and they set up these interrogation centers, which I was talking about earlier, one of which Bruce Lawler advised, through the special police there in South Vietnam. And they would send out hit teams, which they called counter-terror teams, which of course are glorified today. It's Navy SEAL operations, it's special forces operations, to go out and get what are called high-value targets and bring them to these interrogation centers where they could be worked over and turned into double agents, or certainly made to rat out all their colleagues. The Phoenix operation, the Phoenix program, was basically doing in South Vietnam what the Gestapo did in occupied France in World War II. It was doing in South Vietnam what the Einsatzgruppen, the SS, the German SS, was doing, trying to hunt down partisans, the same people that formed the Maquis in Paris and resisted the German occupation. That's exactly what the Phoenix program was doing. It was highly systematized. It was computerized. It was the first time that data was fed into a computer. All the names of these 250,000 people, all their names were fed into computers so that the whole operation could be run out of what was called a Phoenix directorate in Saigon, and Phoenix centers, which were called intelligence operations coordinating centers, were set up in every district and province in South Vietnam to hunt the civilian apparatus. And I should add, those Phoenix IOCs, intelligence operations coordinating centers, are the model for fusion centers here in the United States today. The Department of Homeland Security has been set up using the exact same system. They're highly computerized centers, one set up in every state that has computer information on every dissident, every possible, anybody who's could potentially be seen as an opponent to whatever regime, whether it's the Obama regime or the forthcoming Trump regime that's in power, anybody who that might be operating in the environmental activist community who could be seen as a threat to, for example, in Standing Rock. If a corporation wants to build a pipeline in the United States, well, you can be sure that everybody who's organizing against that, that their names are being fed into a fusion center computer, and that these people's lives are totally, that they're surveilled, and everything that you can be known about them is known about them. So that's exactly that's how Phoenix becomes the model for Homeland Security. At the same time, the CIA has set up similar IOCs intelligence operations coordinated centers all around the world. It was part of their reorganization in 2015 at the same time that it set up its new digital innovation division, its fifth division. The first, it always had four divisions up until 2015. Now it has a fifth division, which is strictly computers and the internet. And it also set up all these centers all around the world run by what are called targeting officers. And every one of them has a computer, and they're doing the same thing, whether it's in the Middle East, whether targeting Islamics or jihadis, or actually funding them and using them through espionage operations. That's how this whole Phoenix operation has become systematized and spread across the world. And people associate it purely with special forces operations. And like Navy SEAL operations. But it's much, much more complicated than that. It involves liaison with police forces. It involves standard espionage operations. It's the whole schmear. Every part of the United States government that's operating overseas in a particular region, in a particular area, is coordinated in one of these centers so that everything can be brought together and managed and organized in the most efficient way. That Phoenix goes way beyond just merely these kind of special forces operations that it's associated with.
I appreciate that detailed explanation. Can you take a look at Ukraine? Because at this moment, Ukraine and also Poland, which is already in NATO, is a pivotal player in the increasing tensions between the United States and Russia. And just recently, it was announced that the United States is sending troops to Poland, I believe about 10,000, to be at the Russians' border. Nevertheless, the United States continues to deny our involvement in the region in its coup in the Ukraine. But we have evidence from WikiLeaks that Hillary Clinton and Gloria Nuland and Obama were directly involved in orchestrating the coup that got out a democratically elected government. So what can you tell us about the CIA's role in the installation of a neo-fascist and anti-Russian government in that country?
Well, I wish I knew the names of the specific CIA officers that were involved, but I don't know their names or the names of the individuals. I have heard some information about the individuals, but the CIA has had an association with the Ukraine since its creation. And it's well known, it's been documented. There's a good book out with a lot of information in it. The book was edited by Stephen Lendman, and he got a bunch of authors together, which talk a lot about, there's about 20 articles in it, and each one of them addresses a specific facet of what was going on in the Ukraine over the last 75 years. But I'm sure that you know, in World War II, there were a lot of Nazi collaborators in Ukraine. A guy named Stephen Bandera actually worked, he was one of the people that was a Nazi collaborator and was responsible for countless massacres of people who were not pro-Nazi in the Ukraine. And he's still a hero there today. There's monuments for him. And since the sort of coup that occurred there, he's actually become prominent again, and there's statues for him and stuff. Anyway, that's just to let you know that the CIA has been operating in Ukraine for 75 years. It one of the first things that the CIA did was recycle a man named Reinhard Gehlen. Reinhard Gehlen had been in charge of German intelligence in Eastern Europe, including the Ukraine. and at the end of World War II. The CIA hired this guy, Reinhard Gehlen, because he still had his agent net in place. And a lot of that agent net encompasses Ukraine. And they made this guy, Reinhard Gehlen, chief of intelligence for West Germany. The CIA for, like I said, it's not, you can't point to any individual event. It's been an evolution. And for the last 70 years, the CIA has been recruiting people in the Ukraine, in businesses, in the government. It's sort of been the front line, the Ukraine, like Poland, in the modern manifestation of the Cold War against the Russians, where the Russians are trying to influence through their espionage and economic operations, try to get control of political and social movements in the Ukraine. And at the same time, the CIA and a lot of other Western governments have also been operating there, trying to shape the narrative. The most telling incident is that immediately in 2015, there was a coup and a pro-Western government took over, Vice President Joe Biden's son, Hunter, went to work for one of the biggest oil companies in Ukraine. And this, again, this shows that it's a demonstration that the reason that this is done, it's not just political, to have political influence in Ukraine, but again, there's economic interests there that free traders in the United States, the faction of the economy that makes its wealth overseas, that these are the people that the CIA is working for, not the average Joe on the street, but for these big corporations. And as soon as they effect a coup, then and they are able to control the politics in a country like Ukraine, well, lo and behold, soon all these contracts and positions of power are being filled by people who are ideologically compatible with America, if not like Hunter Biden, actually Americans, or Jaresko, the woman who took over the biggest data group there. I can't remember her first name, but she's another example, and I mentioned her in my book as well. She got Ukrainian citizenship the same day she became, I think it was Treasury Secretary in the Ukraine. You know, so it was just a coup, but the CIA, through its subordination, through its agent operations, paves the way for these kind of silent coups.
Thank you for that answer. Several very serious and related international crimes the CIA has engaged in for decades would include the illegal drug trade, weapons deals, and money laundering related to drugs and weapons. Iran-Contra is one of the first big incidences exposing the level of CIA corruption, and then later the revelations of investigative journalist Gary Webb, and I'll digress for a moment. In 1996, Gary exposed how the CIA hired drug dealer Danilo Blandon and other traffickers to sell massive amounts of cocaine in the United States in order to raise untraceable funds to finance a terrorist organization known as the Contras, who were trying to overthrow the Nicaraguan government. And these massive shipments of cocaine ultimately sparked the crack epidemic that decimated the inner dry city of Los Angeles and other cities during the 1990s. And as a result, the mainstream media vilified Gary Webb and destroyed his career, which also led to the destruction of his marriage. But Gary refused to back down and stood firm against the system. And in 2004, Gary was found dead with two bullet wounds in his head. I was a friend of Gary. He called me a lot. We spoke. And I know that the CIA had to have been behind that. In any case, there was also The CIA's role in the drug weapons trade goes well beyond the Iran-Contras. The CIA has worked alongside the DEA on engaging in the war against drugs and supporting the culture of terror in Latin America for decades. And then there's the more recent Project Gunrunner, dealing with the Mexican drug cartels and weapons. And earlier, there was the opium and heroin trade in the Gold Triangle, Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia and Thailand. And so provide an overview of the CIA's drug trade activity. And the question really is why? What is the long-term strategic goal behind decades of supporting international drug wars when, quite frankly, can have all the money at once? Anyone in our government can get all the money they want for any of these black op operations. And how does this fit into a larger imperialist, hegemonic, and global vision?
Until, you know, I mean, since World War II, the United States has felt like it is the world's policeman. And it designates good guys and bad guys. Inevitably, the good guys are right on the right. They're and the bad guys are on the left. You don't get into a position of power within the CIA or the United States if you have leftist leanings. I mean, the countries that you're talking about are invariably countries which are trying to free themselves from American influence and are trying to be independent of American influence. So that's pretty much how enemies are selected. And if you're resisting American influence, then you're an enemy, and your country has to be destabilized. Phil Agee and John Stockwell wrote eloquently 40 years ago about exactly what the methods and the purposes are of these things, and it hasn't changed. And the best way wearing down people who will not accept your rule, your economic, the United States wanting to take over the economies of these countries, the best way to wear them down is to destabilize them. And Mexico is a very good example. Mexico has always been viewed as a potential enemy. Trump played on those ancient fears very successfully. And so using Mexico as an example, the United States policy has always been to destabilize it, to smuggle guns into various factions, Mexican factions that have a gripe with the central government. The Mexican-American border has always been not just a question of drugs coming into the United States. It's also been a smuggling of guns back into Mexico. And wherever you have the arms trade, you have the drug trade. Wherever you have the drug trade, you have the arms trade. And also you have billions of dollars of cash that needs to be laundered. So you have a laundering, a drug money, arms laundering business that goes on that's worth billions of dollars. And all of that money goes through the CIA into keeping these destabilization operations in progress. And if it's not a secret, it's just that the media doesn't talk about it, but this is exactly what was happening in the Golden Triangle during the Vietnam War. A guy who preceded Gary Webb, Al McCoy, wrote eloquently about the politics of heroin in Southeast Asia. His book that came out in 1972 was like a Bible for me. And McCoy also suffered like Gary Webb. He after his book came out, and the CIA tried to stop publication of his book. The guy who set up, the senior CIA officer, a guy named Cord Meyer, who actually set up Operation Mockingbird, which was a CIA operation to penetrate the media in the 1950s and 60s. This guy, Cord Meyer, tried to have McCoy's book suppressed. McCoy ended up going to and living in Australia for 10 years. So there's, if you start exposing these operations, you've got to pay a price. But the whole idea is to destabilize through the arms and drug trade nations that are resisting United States hegemony. And of course the media goes along with it. As I said earlier, it's impossible to distinguish them from the CIA anymore. I could go into a lot more detail if you wanted to.
No, we're out of time. Douglas, just today, the former CIA counterterrorism officer and whistleblower John Caracalla wrote a piece concluding that the nation does not need the present CIA and it should be immediately purged. And I recognize there are many ifs and buts connected with the Trump-Russian-Putin battle and whether or not Russia was directly involved in the hacking. And what Caracalla argues is that the CIA has lied to the American people and generated fake news for decades, and now we're supposed to trust them? Hardly. A particularly egregious example is when the CIA got caught conducting torture on prisoners, including innocent people in secret prisons, and it lied about it. And the American media supported its lies. It lied about hacking the computers of the investigators assigned to the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence while the torture program was being examined. And John Brennan, who was involved in these programs under Bush, and a complete disaster in every respect, is still Obama's director of the CIA. And so it goes. Thank you very much for all your good work and for your coming on the program. We really appreciate it. My guest, Douglas Valentine. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Have a nice day.
There's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need escalate. You see, war is not